So I have the pleasure in introducing His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj Swamiji. In 1970, Radhanath Swamiji left his home in America and traveled to India to live the life of a sadhu or a wandering monk. To do that, he traveled through many Asian regions like Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, Russia. And so he had many experiences on the way. When he came here, he lived in the Himalayas with monks and learned about spirituality and mysticism. And he recently published a memoir called The Journey Home. And this was what I had the honor of helping to launch here in Mumbai, the launch of the book. And it's really an engaging yarn. It's almost a love story. And the evocation of a transcendent paradise with really interesting experiences of mysticism. And we'd be happy to share with you the book as you leave. Please take a copy if you like. Radhanath Swami emerged from his years of travels wanting to explain to others the beauty and the rewards of life devoted to God. And therein lay a dilemma. His many followers and friends describe him as completely selfless and consequently unwilling to take credit for his work, and very restless when a spotlight is focused on him. He speaks softly, just like every monk that you have heard of. And I always wondered why he did that. And yesterday I was reading a book on Gandhi, and you remember the gentleman who we met in Mahabaleshwar, Graham, who wrote a book on Gandhiji. And he said the one thing that really struck him about Gandhi as he followed his journey was Gandhi never spoke with oratory or a loud voice, or he wasn't very persuasive. But when he spoke, it was a soft-spoken strength of steel. And it is a soft-spoken way of persuading people that so characterized the father of our nation. That reminded me a little bit of Maharaji. He's like that. He speaks so softly and gently. But his stories just hit and touch your heart. And that's why he has so many devotees across the world. He has met with Anand Mai. He's met with Swami Satchinanda, the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa. And this is his headquarters here at Chowpatty in Mumbai. For 20 years, he has directed the community development in this urban part of Bombay. Here we have a program called the Midday Meal, which serves 175,000 plates of vegetarian food to municipal schools, to missionary hospitals, eye camps, and they are both Muslim schools and Hindu schools. They're Christian schools and anyone in need. He sees life as a continuous blessing of God's grace, said one follower, yet he never loses his humaneness. His accessibility to people, he's willing to meet everybody, is something that really touches all of us. And he feels that with sincere effort, everyone will find a path to inner peace and God realization. I have been to his beautiful home in Chicago. I've met his father. And I always wondered how his parents were such wonderful people that they let a Jewish American boy travel across the world to find himself a journey home, so to speak, and this distant land of India to create this community where he continuously does good for thousands and millions of people. And now we have to share him with the rest of the world, where he travels to Russia for a temple, and there are ISKCON temples now across the world. The most beautiful little one, and I suggest you all do visit there, is in Boston. It's in the lane next to the Taj Mahal Hotel, Commonwealth Avenue. So please do go there for a meal. You'll find many wonderful people there. And it is so beautiful that it's right next to a church and that everybody lives in harmony and spirituality. I'd like to very warmly welcome, on behalf of all of you, Sri Radhanath Swami. So he will give a short discourse and then maybe you can ask questions.
Om Ajnanamitandasya Jnananjanashalakaya Chakshurum Bilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Vanshakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhya evacha Patithanam Bhavanibhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. I welcome everybody this evening to our small temple. We are very, very grateful that you have come. A special gratitude to Jay and Swati and Anand for making this wonderful arrangement. I believe you are students at Harvard University. I was just there in Harvard University in November. I think it's the Kennedy Center. I gave a talk there. But it's such a wonderful world. Now we're in Bombay, and our little room has become Harvard University due to your presence. I really hope you're having a nice experience in India. And I was asked to speak about anything I want to speak. So here it goes. I would like to share with you a story. In January of this year, I was invited to meet with the President of India, Mrs. Pratibha Patil. As our car pulled up to the presidential palace, beautiful place, one security guard after another stopped us, and the person in the back seat said, "This is Radhanath Swami," and they said, "Oh yes, yes, President is expecting you." I went through about four security guards and was soon walking, being escorted through the presidential corridors to her sitting room. And not one person asked to even see my identification. And as I was walking down the corridor, which is really magnificent, there was marble pillars, arches, and on the ceiling, I looked up, and all the 700 verses of Bhagavad Gita were in gold leaf. Really an architectural masterpiece of art. And as I was walking down those corridors, my mind went back exactly 40 years. when I first encountered the security guards of India. I'd like to tell you a little of that story. It's written in this book, The Journey Home, in much detail. But I was born in an American Jewish family from immigrants from Eastern Europe. I was born in Chicago and grew up in a suburb of Chicago, Highland Park. And that was in 1950 when I was born. Something happened. I became a teenager. And playing in the empty lots, baseball and football and soccer and all those things, didn't really mean that much. Because the 1960s, being a teenager, was a time of revolution, ideologies, and serious questions. There was the civil rights movement. I worked a job, and myself and Gary, this is my friend Gary in the back. We've known each other since 10 years old. Would you stand up, Gary, for a moment? He's a lifelong friend. I'll tell you more about him later. Well, we were working with African American people in the mid-60s. And in those days, African Americans did not have freedom. They weren't literally slaves. But if you're born in the ghetto, you live in the ghetto, you die in the ghetto, and there's hardly a couple percent chance that anyone's going to give you the opportunity for anything else but poverty and racial discrimination. Dr. Martin Luther King, he was inspired by India. His guru of the heart was Mahatma Gandhi, who wanted to revolt against injustices to innocent people without violence. Something very special. Nelson Mandela also, he very much honored and emulated Mahatma Gandhi's ideas. So I was a part of the civil rights movement because things didn't make sense. I'm an American living with the idea that this is a free country. But free for who? A free country is not selective. A free country is meant to be magnanimous. Whoever you are, as long as you don't break laws. And here were the people I was working with. Everyone was an alcoholic who took shelter just out of relief from racial discrimination and poverty. At the same time, there was a civil rights, there was the Vietnam War. But in those days, when you turned 18, unless you have a real good reason to get out, you are forcibly drafted. You can ask Gary what he did when he was getting drafted. You had two choices. If you didn't believe in the war, either you fight and kill or die for something that you don't believe in, or you go to prison. The third alternative is to escape America. It was a serious time. And some of our colleagues at Kent State University were having a demonstration, supposed to be a peaceful demonstration. And the National Guard lined up and shot them and killed them, teenage college girls shot dead by the National Guard for expressing what they believed. Myself and Gary, we were tear gassed and chased by club-swinging police when we were simply questioning why are we in Vietnam by the people who we were told were protecting our freedom. Yes, the 1960s was a time when questions were not just based on ideological curiosity. It was based on serious, deep-rooted dissatisfaction with what we were seeing all around us. But eventually, I came to understand that this counterculture wasn't much different than what we were revolting against. To hate people for hating is kind of sharing the same disease, is it not? And I saw decadence with drugs and so much egoism in the counterculture as well. Martin Luther King said, if you don't have an ideal you're willing to die for, you have nothing meaningful to live for. When I heard that, I was thinking, that's it. Life's not just about getting a career and making money and getting a position in society and raising a family. There should be an ideal, a real ideal that we're living for. And we harmonize everything around that. This was my thinking as a teenager. And then I heard the words of Gandhi that we should be the change we want to see in the world. Not just talk about it and revolt about it and demonstrate about it, but actually be it. It means a change of heart within myself. So Gary and I took a summer vacation in 1970 to Europe to see how other people see the world. What's their thoughts about God, society? How do they view America? And what is their spiritual conceptions? We had no money. Actually, Gary called me to Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to a friend's house, and said, I'm going to Europe with Frank, and you must come with us. I said, Gary, I have no money. And I have a job this summer before we go back to college next year. He said, well, that's not a good excuse because I have no money either. He said, Frank is going to pay for all of us. I said, all right, I'll go. I told my mother and father we'll be back in 3 months in time for college. They didn't want me to go, but for a teenager in the 1960s, that was not much of an issue. So we went, and the first day, Frank got robbed, and he left back for America, and Gary and I were alone with nothing except our enthusiasm to learn more about life. We hitchhiked from country to country, place to place. We made the scenes in some places. Rock festivals, London, Amsterdam. But gradually, there was this calling in my heart that was taking me away from all of it. I was going to museums trying to study life through art, going to synagogues, cathedrals, monasteries, natural beautiful places to meditate and to contemplate and to study. And eventually Gary and I were on a mountain in the island of Crete, which is part of Greece. And we were living in a cave in the southern coast. And every day he went down to the seashore to meditate, and I climbed a mountain from sunrise to sunset. I would meditate and pray and study some books, the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita. I had a deep belief because I saw sectarianism. I felt it. How prejudices of ego, whether it comes out in the name of religion or the color of one's skin or one's nationality or one's caste, it's all just different ways to vent our egos. It's not about religion. It's not about the color of the skin. It's not about one's nationality. It's about the ego. And what we cling to, we want to feel ourselves superior to others. And being Jewish, and often being criticized, ridiculed, hated, and I didn't know why, I wanted to understand what is really the essence of what religion is. So I was studying all these different books. And on that mountain, meditating, praying, studying, and one day, there was this fire in my heart, a blazing fire, to understand who I was. What really is meaningful purpose of life? And I was praying all day for direction and crying. And just as the sun was setting, I heard a voice from within. That voice said three words. And I knew if I followed it, my life would never be the same. Would you like to hear those secret three words? Go to India. India? I never met an Indian in my life. I never ate Indian food. I didn't know where India was. I didn't even have a map. But I believed it was the voice of God. I went down to the cave. And Gary was sitting there. He was meditating. It was dark. I said, something amazing happened. He said, something amazing happened to me. I said, what? He said, at sunset, I heard a voice. What did the voice say? He said, you won't believe me. I said, I might. I think I might. He said, the voice said, go to Israel. I said, where? He said, I told you you wouldn't believe me. I said, no, I just didn't hear you. Where? He said, Israel. We should go to Israel together. I said, Gary, he told me to go to India. India? There was complete silence for about 20 minutes. Then I said, Gary, at sunrise tomorrow, I'm leaving for India. And I left him. And I was alone. Began hitchhiking through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. From London, it was a 6-month hitchhike. From Istanbul, it was 3 months. Interestingly, just 2 weeks ago, I flew here from London, and it took me about 9 hours. 40 years before, it took me 6 months to make the exact same journey. It was safer, but not as scenic and not as life-changing. I was 19 years old when I reached the border of India. I was covered with dust. I had many near-death experiences. People tried to murder me. I got diseases hitchhiking through the Middle East. I was studying Christianity, Judaism, and I was studying Islam. I didn't think I could live more than a few more days by the time I reached the Indian border. It was hard. Here I was, steps away from India, the place I risked my life to visit, the place I broke the heart of my parents to achieve. Can you imagine my parents' situation? I promised them 3 months, I'll be back. 4 months passed. They heard nothing from me. Five months later, almost, they finally received a letter that I was going to India, and Gary's no longer with me. And I explained, I'm doing this for educational purposes. So it's just better than going to college. When you're 19, you don't know how to talk to your parents so well. At least I didn't. And then I told them something that there was no way that they could understand what I was saying. I said, please do not worry. It was postmarked Iran with no return address. I wasn't hiding. It's just the hitchhikers don't have return address. They're in a different place every day. Here I was, steps away from India. The immigration agent looked at me, took my passport, looked at my valid visa, and asked a question. How much money do you have? Now, on the way, while I escaped from my life from different situations, I lost my sleeping bag, I lost my everything but a little cloth bag. And I had exactly, I remember, 26 cents. She said, minimum $200 or you cannot enter India. We have enough beggars here. Go back. Where am I going to go back to? I was in the no man's land between two enemy nations, Pakistan and India. Hitchhike all the way back. I couldn't even get it back into Pakistan. I only had a one entry visa. I begged for 6 hours and she turned me away with the guns of the security. I prayed. Eventually the guards changed and a Sikh gentleman took the guard. And when she drove off, I went to him and he said, I have been told you are a nuisance, you are rejected. Show me $200 or go back. I cried and I begged, just give me a chance. I've risked everything to see your people and to learn from you. I promise someday I'll do something good for your people. Just give me a chance. He looked at me for a long minute and he said, Sometimes a man must follow his heart. I have been ordered by my superior officer to reject you, but I am going to give you the chance that you are crying for. He stamped my passport. And he put his hand on my head. He was about 50, I was 19. He said, "May you find what you are longing for. Welcome to India." And I remember it was night by the time I got into the country, and I was just walking through some agricultural fields. I didn't know to turn left or to turn right. I was alone. But I felt at home. As I was walking through the presidential corridors with the top security officials of the nations escorting me, I was remembering this scene. And when I got to the president's room, she was waiting for me with folded hands and a basket of fruit. I told my father this story, who arrived in Bombay this morning. He said, "This is a story of rags to riches." I said, "Not exactly, because I'm a Swami, and Swamis kind of wear rags. And I have nothing to my name. The last bank account I had was in 1969. So I have no riches." But then I was thinking that one grain of truth is a more fulfilling form of wealth than anything else we can possibly acquire within this world. So maybe there is some riches there. The president of India asked me, a very brilliant lady. She asked, "Why, American boy from a middle-class family who studied all the religions of the world, why have you chosen to follow this Hindu religion? And why have you chosen to live in India of all places?" I tried to give her a brief answer, but she was probing deeper and deeper. I'd like to share with you some of the things I told her of what it was about India that really charmed my heart. I was looking for a meaning in life, a purpose of life that was deep and fulfilling. And I believed that had to be connected to spirituality. And I found within the saints and the sages and the teachings of the Vedas, of the scriptures of India, all the things I learned from so many other religious systems. I learned, and I don't say that this can only be learned in India, but this is where I discovered it, that the true essence of every great spiritual path is one. It's beyond sectarianism. In the Bible, it is said, the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, sarva dharman purityajya mam ekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha isami masucha. Which means the essence of all religion is to surrender to the supreme truth with love, to be an instrument of compassion. In the world today, and at my time also, Most educational facilities equip us with incredible tools of knowledge. Knowledge of economy, of business, of science, of technology, of literature. But in order to actually do something good for the world, it's not the tools alone. It has to be the character of the person who has the tools. To develop character, integrity, dignity is very much what religion is about. It's what humanity is about. A knife is just a neutral thing. When the knife is in the hands of a thief, it slashes someone's throats to kill them. When that same knife is in the hands of a doctor, it saves a life. Is the knife good or bad? Scientists, technologists, economists, business people, politicians, with the power and the information that they have, they could either create mass destruction or mass benefits. And this is all important. In the Bhagavad Gita, there's a beautiful explanation that, this is a Vedic conception, that real humanity, real spirituality, is to be para dukkha dukkhi, which means to have the consciousness where the sufferings of others is my suffering and the happiness of others is my happiness. In other words, compassion. Compassion for the body, for the mind, and for the Atma, the living force. In the Bhagavad Gita, the central book of teachings for India, this is the foundational teaching. Who am I? We have this body. We're not an eye, but we're seeing through the eye, smelling through the nose, tasting through the tongue, feeling through the flesh, thinking through the brain, feeling through the heart. But who is that witness? The body's always changing from childhood to youth to old age. And the mind is also always changing too. When we were babies, we were thinking of the milk of our mothers. When was the last time you thought of the milk of your mother? The mind changes, the body changes, but who is the witness? Who am I? The Bhagavad Gita explains we are the Atma, or the living force that is the source of consciousness within. And when that living force is within the body is animated. The body is compared to a car. And we are the driver of the car. And the purpose of the car is to serve the needs of the driver. The car needs gasoline. But if I drink gasoline, I'm not going to be satisfied. So everyone is looking for fulfillment and satisfaction in life. And the Gita is explaining, if you want to be happy, you have to understand how to satisfy the body, the mind, and the true self, who we really are. There's a very simple example of a lady who has a bird in a cage. And she spends so much of her time decorating the cage. A neighbor comes and she says, look at the beauty of this bird cage. And the person's horrified. The bird cage has gilded decorations and pearls, but the bird inside is dead, of starvation. You've put all your energy into decorating the cage, but you forgot about the bird. The whole purpose of a cage is a nice place for the bird. To nourish ourselves physically through exercise, through proper food, mentally through proper relationships, positive understandings of life, and to nourish ourselves spiritually through spiritual knowledge and spiritual practices that actually connect us and awaken the nature of the soul, which according to the Gita, the soul is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. The love and the happiness that we are seeking in everything we do is within us. And if we can't find it there, we can't really find it anywhere. And the Gita teaches we should not give up our occupation or our skills or our occupational or social responsibilities, but we should connect. Religion comes from the Latin word religio, which means to bind back, and yoga means to reunite. They mean exactly the same thing, to reconnect with who we really are, our essence. And instead of feeling that I have to acquire so many things from outside of myself, so many physical pleasures, so many things, so many positions, so many titles to be happy, because the more you get, the more you need. We actually find that inner happiness within ourselves, and through our occupation, through our social interconnections, we express that love, that compassion in whatever we do. And that doesn't mean we become lazy. Love is a much more powerful motivating force than selfishness. The love of a mother is she's willing to do anything, anytime for her child. Love is without selfishness. That love is within us. To connect to that is the essence and purpose of all spiritual paths, of all religions. And the Bhagavad Gita explains this so clearly. And if we go deep to any real religious scripture, we find that same essence, that same treasure. The Gita teaches that we are responsible for what we do. It is called karma. This word is misunderstood much more than it's understood. It's a simple law. It's a law of nature. Just like there's the law of gravity. What goes up must come down, whether you believe it or not. Newton told us, Isaac Newton, that for every action, there is an equal corresponding reaction. The Bible says, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. What I was taught in Chicago, what goes around comes around. It's the same thing. What we say and what we do is going to come back. Now, this idea of karma is not supposed to judge people. It's not that somebody's suffering, so we just look at them and say, it's your fault. You did something. The spirit is important. The idea is to transform us into compassionate, responsible beings. It's not our business what people did in the past. It's our business whatever suffering people are enduring, that we should be instruments to help them. But in our own personal life, we take responsibility for what we do and what we say because we know it's going to come back to us. And with these understandings, when we take responsibility and try to connect actually to that inner spiritual joy, then the pressures and the stress of this world help us to grow. Today in the workplace, stress is a serious subject matter. I know some of our people from India who graduated from IIT, they went to America and got jobs in Wall Street, and there is so much stress for these people. Unbelievable. They come and tell me. Everyone wants their job. Everyone wants to overcome them. Some of them are working 7 days a week and sometimes 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day, just to keep up with the stress. Otherwise, they'll lose their jobs. They're getting paid a lot, but the quality of their life is not so happy. But it could be. When stress is properly managed, it makes us grow. Positive outlook, which is a natural byproduct of connecting to our own spirituality. Just like a weightlifter, the heavier the weights, the more the person becomes strong by lifting them. And that means resistance. If it's too much, if you don't know how to monitor it properly, you could break your limbs and pull your muscles. But if you do it the right way, you become strong. Gary is my friend. He can tell you all about this weightlifting stuff. When we left America together, we were on a spiritual search. I didn't see him. We had no communication. It's a long story. You could read about it in the book if you like. For 18 years, he didn't know where I was. I didn't know where he was. And when we met, that's a very inconceivable story, but somehow or other we met in Malibu Beach, California. And, you know, in India, I was living in caves and living in Himalayas and living in ashrams and all different places, wandering as a penniless sadhu for years. And finally we met. And that skinny little Gary was a really big guy. He was a bodybuilder and a physical trainer at the Malibu gym. And when we were talking together, Gary said to me, "What do we have in common? How are we still such good friends? We're totally opposite. My life is teaching people that if they have strong, healthy bodies, they'll be happy, and your life is telling people that you're not a body, you're a soul." I said, "Gary," I was remembering my guru's teachings. I said, "The body is like a temple of God. You teach people how to have a nice temple, and I'll try to tell them what to do inside, and we'll work together." And we've been working together ever since. Yoga means to harmonize the body, mind, and soul for holistic, complete health. So when a weightlifter is lifting weights, if he does it properly, the stress makes him stronger. When a runner is running, the lungs are pumping. It's a stress, but it increases endurance. And the exams you have in college, for some of you, it's stressful. But that stress is meant to help you to really focus and prepare yourselves and understand and digest the message. So in a similar way, the challenges that come in life, if we have the proper positive approach to them, and if we're actually connecting to that inner foundation of spiritual joy, spiritual fulfillment, then the stresses of life bring us more wisdom. The tribulations, the traumas, the crises, success, failure, honor, dishonor, pleasure, pain, these dualities are always coming. They're all meant to make us grow. We have that choice. And real spirituality is meant to prepare us to become better human beings and more proficient in whatever we do and closer to God through all situations in life. Our dear Ananda Pirimal, he just had a serious surgery. And he was completely positive. I was speaking to his mother and father sometimes on the phone, and they were saying when he came out of before the surgery and after the surgery, he was thanking God and grateful for whatever he had and grateful for the experience. Now, the same person who goes through the same thing could be depressed, could feel, why me? Could be confused. And how is he taking it in such a positive way? Where he's so much absorbed in thinking of how to help others, even when he's in this condition? Because he has a spiritual foundation. And this is beautiful. If a house has a strong foundation, the Bible says this, if you build your house on shifting sand, then the first storm will make it crumble. But if you build your house on solid rock, any storm, nothing can knock it down. This building here, we may say beautiful wood, beautiful stone carvings, nice altar. But nobody ever says, this building has a really good foundation. You don't see it, but it holds up everything. A few years ago, there was an earthquake in Latur, and this whole building was shaking like anything. 200 kilometers away, 10,000 people died. But because this building has a strong foundation, even an earthquake could not hurt it. So similarly, when we have a strong inner foundation based on our character, our integrity, and our spiritual awareness, then the difficulties that come in life make us deeper in our wisdom and more empowered in what we can do for the world. Because real happiness is not about taking, it's about giving. And when we have that, we could always give something. We may not always get. But if we're grateful, whatever we do get, we could be happy, whatever it may be. And this type of wisdom, this type of detachment, this type of inner satisfaction is the beauty that is so prevalent in India. When people talk about India, do I have a few more minutes? Oh, it's cool. Okay, should I continue for a couple more minutes? Sometimes I'm in the West. I spent about almost half my time traveling in the West and half my time here in Bombay. People question. In India, women are abused. It's true. It's true. There's persecution of women. There's persecution of castes. There's persecution of religions. There's persecutions of everything, everywhere. India is a very complex country. It has extremes on both directions and everything in between. I think you're getting that experience. There's the most extreme poverty. There's extreme wealth. There's extreme knowledge. There's extreme ignorance. There's extreme compassion, there's extreme cruelty. But I've never seen a country that honors women more than India. Even my mother and father, when they see that, they've never seen anything like it. Every woman is supposed, by cultured people who understand the tradition, every woman should be honored and respected like your mother. And that's holy. India's longest standing prime minister was a lady, Indira Gandhi. The president of India today is a lady. The ruler of the leader of the ruling party is an Italian Christian lady, Sonia Gandhi. And Mrs. Swati Piramal, last year, she was the president of the Chamber of Commerce for India. She was the person meeting dignitaries from all over the world, or whatever it's called, something like a Chamber of Commerce. And some of the greatest worshipped saints in the past and the present are ladies. Dalai Lama, when he escaped exile, he came to India. And how much he has been sheltered here. And I've met him many times, and with tears in his eyes, he expresses his gratitude to the land and the people of India for giving shelter to him and his people. India has one of the oldest Jewish communities in the world. They came here, some for trade, some because they persecuted for other nations, and they were given all rights and just absorbed themselves right in the society. Christianity began here at the time of St. Thomas, one of the original apostle of Jesus, came to South India and started, and it's been here ever since, growing and expanding. There has been Sikh presidents of India. There has been Muslim presidents of India. The Parsis were persecuted in Iran, and almost all of them came to India, where they're some of the most successful doctors and industrialists in the country. As far as Muslims, it's the second largest Muslim country in the world. Great politicians, presidents have been Muslims. Most popular entertainers, many of them are Muslims. And traveling around the world, I see that Muslims, although there's problems with communalism and sectarianism, they have more rights in India than practically anywhere I've seen in the whole planet. India is a very open place. There's a lot of craziness. People have been battling against these caste considerations based on ignorance. But through it all, I see it like a pond that has a lot of sewage and toxic waste in it. But despite it all, there's a magnificent garden of lotus flowers with beauty and wisdom and compassion. And the world is starting to recognize this in India now. I was recently invited by Mike Milken, who is a financial person in America, to speak to some of his friends in Beverly Hills. And he introduced me, besides introducing me as an author and, you know, our own relationship, he was explaining the importance of India in the world today. He said, one out of every six CEOs in Silicon Valley is born in India. Soon India is going to have the largest population in the world. And the businesses and the technology and the brilliance. Gary's uncle and aunt, Donald Sterling and Shelley Sterling, who own an NBA basketball team and a Beverly Hills hotel and all kinds of real estate, They told me every single one of their doctors are Indian. They won't take any other doctor except an Indian because they're the most proficient. So India's really coming to view of this world. And my understanding from being here for about 40 years is it's about that foundational culture of openness, of compassion, of love, that's really the background that makes the people in the country with such a potential. And forgetfulness of that has created so many problems. You see, in India, the name of the religion really is Sanatan Dharma. Dharma means that which is inseparable from one's existence. The dharma of sugar is its sweet. The dharma of a chili pepper is its hot. You may have gotten some since you've been here. The dharma of fire is heat. What is our dharma? Dharma means our duty, our religion, our occupation, but essentially it means what is inseparable to who we are. Sanatan Dharma means our eternal nature, what is inseparable from us as spiritual beings. Our dharma is to serve with love, to serve with compassion. That is what Sanatan Dharma means. And that is very much the essence of all great spiritual paths. It's the essence of human character. And when I was explaining these things to the president, I said, because of this all-inclusiveness, a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a Jain, a Parsi, a Sikh, they are if they're following their religion properly, or a Hindu, that is Sanatan Dharma. Yoga is meant to unite, to connect, not divide. And this is a great need in the world, especially among leaders. The Gita says, yad yad acharati sreshtas tad tad evitaro jana, that what leaders do affects everyone. Their example very much is influential. A mother's a leader. A father's a leader. We're all leaders in our own ways. What is important for all of us is to really come to the occasion to be real leaders. Whether we're in finance or business or industry, or whether we're accountants or whether we're swamis, if we live with integrity, with character, with compassion, and we have these spiritual roots that give us that foundation to not compromise our dignity even when there's temptation or fear, then we're real leaders. And then we can make a real change in the world. I'll end by telling one short story. Here in Bombay, I was speaking in a college of chartered and certified accountants. There was a big auditorium. About 300 or 400 students were there. And I gave a lecture. I don't remember what I talked about. And after the lecture, I asked if there was any questions. One student stood up. As soon as this man stood up, he was in his mid-20s. Everyone in the auditorium looked to him and went, ooh. And I understood this man is very charismatic and influential. And he screamed at me. He yelled, everything you said is completely useless, and I reject it. And everybody was really happy, because people like to see their teachers challenged, I guess. He said, what if everybody in the world became a swami like you? Who would grow the food? Who would run the governments? Who would do the trading and the banking? Who would do the medical work? Therefore, I have to say, whatever you said is completely useless, and I reject it. And he got a standing ovation. I was waiting for the crowd to settle down, and I said a little prayer to give me the words to speak. Should I tell you what I said? I said, dear sir, what if everyone in the world became an accountant like you? Who would grow the food? Who would do the banking and the industry? Who would do the medical stuff or run the governments? In fact, if everyone in the world became an accountant like you, no one would need an accountant, so the entire world would be 100% unemployment. I said, the world needs accountants. The world needs farmers. The world needs bankers and business people and industrialists and politicians and farmers and doctors. The world needs all of these. And there's also a place in the world for swamis. We all have our service to humanity. The purpose of a swami is to help to give a spiritual dimension to everyone else who's doing whatever they're doing, so that they could find that inner fulfillment and that inner love and express it through whatever we do. So a real society, everyone is working together like a body. The body has hands and legs and eyes and nose, and they all have... It's not that the eyes are saying to the hands, I'm better than you. You can't do what I can do. Every part of the body is unique, but everyone's working for this, for the whole body. In the same way, society, when there's a spiritual foundation, we're all working together with love, with compassion for the whole society. Greed is toxic. Compassion is healing. And when I said that, I got a bigger standing ovation than he did. I have to humbly say. And this family, Ajay and Swati Piramal, Anand, Nandini, Peter, they really are an exemplary family like this. I don't know all the things that they do because they do so much, but from my little perspective, you know, they're influential, they're successful. But because of this strong, deep spiritual foundation, which is based on wisdom, knowledge, and experience, and faith, they recycle the wonderful gifts that God has given them in such a way for the welfare of the world. Besides all the other things they do, I know just before I left for India last time, we met, and they offered to help with some of the projects. And this is just what they've done in the last 6-8 months. We have this midday meals, which is feeding, you know, many children in the slum schools. You see, in India, hunger is a big problem. Children are hungry. They can't concentrate in school when they're hungry. So they drop out of school and they become beggars. But you can't just become a beggar in a place like Bombay. You have to be under the supervision of a mafia for many of those children to be beggars. And you come under their subjugation. or they work child labor where there's cruelty. And the government approached us and said, if we could just feed them in the school, they'll stay in school and they won't go to the mafia or to beggars or to child labor. So we've been trying. And they are feeding 50,000 children a day, every day, the Piramal family. And they've given so much for our hospital, which is healing people who are going blind from cataracts, who can't possibly afford the operation. We do free camps, and they've been helping with that for years. And medical relief, and so many other ways, culturally, educationally. You know, this family, they've really imbibed that essence of the beauty of the tradition, of this very open, inclusive culture of Indian wisdom, and applying it to their lives. It's not that Hinduism is better than another religion, or being an Indian is better than being another. I'm American. But to access that inner love within our heart, to feel that compassion, and to really make a serious change within the world through whatever we're empowered to do, that is something beautiful. In whatever form it comes, in whatever name is attached to it. And these are some of the beautiful things that I learned here in India. And I thank you very much. If there's any questions, you can ask, and I'm prepared after that one in the accountant school. Would anyone like to ask any questions? Yes, sir.
You mentioned that religion has the power to unite and you bring people together. And when I look at the world today, there seems to be a big divide, which has its roots in religion, and specifically, between the Muslim world and the rest of the world, you could say. And you know, in India in particular, it's been an issue over the last decade or so with the riots in Bombay and in Gujarat and events in Ayodhya, for example. Now, do you think that India has worked past those issues? Do you still see divisions? Do you still see risks of persecution going forward? On the one hand, there have been leaders that have been of one religion versus the other, but on the other hand, the divisions still remain. I'm wondering whether you think that those walls or barriers are breaking down.
It is still very much there. But my observation is, it's not about religion. It's about ego. Somehow or other, we want ourselves to be best. And Christians persecuted Jews. Buddhists have persecuted Hindus. Muslims have persecuted Jews. Jews have persecuted Muslims. Catholics have persecuted Protestants. It's gone on as long as... And if it's not in the name of religion, it's in the name of something else. Yes? The real thing is we have to educate people about really what is the essence of religion. We can't do away with religion. We have to teach people what it really is and what it's not. If it's not developing forgiveness, love, and compassion, and making us humble, and seeing every living being, even if they're an atheist, as a child of God, who deserves our respect, it's not religion at all. It's just an external form. The Bible, there's a statement, you understand the letter of the law of your religion, but you do not understand the spirit and the power behind it. The religions of the world, each one has its own explanation of God. Each one has its own explanation of creation. There's so many similarities and some differences. Different rituals, different places, different languages, different dress. But they're all meant ultimately for the purpose of making us forgiving, compassionate, loving, spiritual beings. There's a beautiful verse in the Gita. When I heard this, I thought, this is it. This is what real religion is about. Vidyavanaya sampani brahmani gavihastini suni chaiva supakecha pandita samadarshana. This means a person who's actually knowledge and enlightenment sees every living being with equal vision. Whether one is black or white or red or yellow in color, whether one is male or female, whether one is Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or Jain or Zoroastrian or Parsi or Sikh or atheist, whether one is a human or an elephant or a cow or a dog or a cat, whether it's from the east or the west, rich or poor, these are all external things. An enlightened person sees that there's a part of God in everyone. When we understand the Atma, the living force, the soul within ourself, that we can experience that soul in everyone. The Gita tells, Aham Bija Pratapita, that the Lord is the father and mother of everyone. Religion means to become enlightened. And enlightenment means to see the essence, to see the relationship we have with every living being beyond all these temporary designations. We could change our religion, we could change our nationality due to the powers of modern science, we could change our sex, we can change anything. But who we really are, that spiritual spark, that beautiful part of God is within everyone. To see that, to love that, is to be religious. And that's what every religious is teaching in its essence. But we get so caught up in all the external forms and all the external rituals that we have so much to fight about. But the fighting and the hating is totally contrary to the very purpose of the religion we follow. People need to be educated in that. Saragrahi, to seek the essence. In 1971, I was living in Patna in Bihar on the bank of the Ganges. I was 20 at the time. And there was a man, he was 85, who was my best friend. He was older than my grandfather, but we were like friends. His name was Narayan Prasad. We would talk for hours every day. About 11 o'clock in the morning, each day, he took me to his best friend's house. His name was Mohammed. He ran an X-ray clinic. And he was a Muslim. And the two of them, for 1 hour every day, would discuss spirituality. Mohammed would speak from the Quran. Narayan Prasad would speak from the Bhagavad Gita and the Ramayana. Hindu scriptures. And I would speak whatever mixed up stuff I was learning. But what was beautiful, it wasn't that they were tolerating each other for their differences. They were actually appreciating and loving each other for their differences. There's something called unity in diversity. The diversity of different spirituality is actually makes everything more beautiful if we could recognize the unity that is underlining it. So one day I was sitting on the bank of the river and I asked Narayan Prasad, how is it possible in a country like India, where there is so much communal conflict between Muslims and Hindus, that you, a Hindu, have a best friend who's a Muslim? And you love each other's religions. How is this possible? I'll never forget his answer. He said, if a dog has a master, the dog will recognize the master in whatever way the master dresses. Sometimes the master's in a tuxedo, sometimes in blue jeans and t-shirt, sometimes in a bathing suit. Sometimes the master's not dressed in anything at all. Whatever clothes he comes in, the dog recognizes the master. If we cannot recognize our God when he appears in a different dress, at a different time, in a different place, to different people, if we cannot recognize, love, and appreciate that revelation of God for someone else, he told me, then we are lower than a dog. And we have so much to learn from a dog. So yes, there's serious problems in India. There's serious problems in so many places in the world. Something that is meant to unite and create the foundation of forgiveness, compassion, and equal vision is being used for an opposite purpose. Education is very important. Does that answer your question? And you had a question also?
Firstly, thank you again for speaking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for tolerating me for so long.
It's our pleasure. Earlier today, Mr. Piramal was sharing with us a powerful anecdote that has helped him get through some tough times and maintain his spirituality. If it's not too personal, I was wondering if you could share a time where your spirituality has been tested, if one such exists, and what, if anything, kind of helped you maintain your faith and your spirituality throughout.
Actually, this whole book, The Journey Home, is about all those times on my spiritual journey. But to choose one, yes, sometimes when we try to do good, people appreciate us, and sometimes people hate us because it's not the way they want us to do it. And when we're hated, the natural human instinct is to hate in return. There's an example that if you're really angry at somebody, and to feel vengeful toward somebody is like picking up a red hot burning coal to throw at the person. The problem is that when you pick it up, who gets burnt? You get burnt. There's a Chinese proverb that if you want to get even with someone with vengeance, then you should dig two graves. Because it's polluting ourselves. It's It's corrupting ourselves, just holding on to anger or envy or hatred. To forgive is sacred. We may have to be competitive externally according to the time, place, and circumstances, but internally, to forgive is sacred. To forgive liberates us. To hold on to envy or hatred is like holding on to that hot coal. Booker T. Washington, he was an emancipated slave. He wrote something very beautiful. He wrote, "I will allow no man to degrade my soul by causing me to hate them. No matter what anyone does to me," and people really persecuted him. He was an African-American slave. He said, "It will degrade my soul if they cause me to hate them. I will not allow anyone to do that, whatever they do to me." These are spiritual principles. Universal spiritual principles. So yes, when I encounter this kind of thing, to deal with it with compassion, to deal with it, we may hate the disease, but we should love the diseased, because we're all brothers and sisters, and we should recognize that essence within ourselves. I remember thinking of a particular example. At one time, I was told I had 6 months to live. Two doctors told me I had an incurable disease and I couldn't survive more than 6 months. This was in the early 80s. I was about 29 years old or something like that. And I remember when you get news like that, certain things that you really think are really important aren't so important anymore. And you really kind of have to focus on what really is important. And that's really a blessing when you have the opportunity, which usually requires a necessity to do so. So I started thinking, you know, I could be miserable. I could be fearful. I could be depressed. That's one alternative. Or I could be grateful that with this information, I could really focus on what's really, really important in life. Because the quality of human life is not based on how many years we live. It's based on the quality of who we are. There's a tree in Sweden, a Norwegian spruce, that according to scientists, it's 9,500 years old. That person, that what we call the soul, the Atma, has been in that tree body for 9,500 years, a lot of winters. Jesus Christ lived 31 years. Sripad Shankaracharya lived 32 years. The great saint avatar Lord Chaitanya lived 48 years. But they changed the world. What they represented, what they exemplified, what they taught, even today, thousands or hundreds of years later, is affecting millions and millions of people's lives. So who is more important, these people are that Norwegian spruce tree. So I was thinking, you know, maybe this is God's gift to really get me to focus on what's important. And I did. I focus on two things: my relationship with God, accessing the eternal treasures of my soul before I die, and my health. I drank about 1 gallon of water a day and ate raw foods for about a year. And at the same time, I really, really deeply, when I was doing my prayers or my chanting, within our tradition, we chant God's names. Krishna is not a sectarian name of God. Krishna means the all-attractive, the all-beautiful, the all-loving. And Radha is the feminine aspect of the divine. So I was chanting this Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, not just as a ritual, not just as something that's supposed to be done. I was taking shelter. I was going deep. And in my prayer, and in my charity, everything was really deep. Everything was really qualitatively, because the superficialities really didn't mean anything to me anymore. And I gained a lot of wisdom because of a spiritual foundation. It was intense getting that news, but I tried to take it as an opportunity instead of a curse. What's a blessing and what's a curse is our interpretation. We could transform curses into blessings, or we could transform blessings into curses according to how we appreciate it, according to what we look for in that situation. Anyways, that was in about 1980. That was 30 years ago. And I'm still here. But a lot of wonderful, wonderful vision and wisdom and insights I got from that experience. And I thank God for it. Does that kind of answer your question?
Very much.
Thank you. Is there any other question? Yes, Anandji.
You said that spirituality is internal and that the kingdom of heaven lies within. Many of us at business school, for us pursuing wealth is an important part of our lives. But, you know, on one hand, happiness is internal, but on the other hand, with money you get influence, you get security, you get, so many other things. You get comfort, you get, how can we say that it's not important when it serves so many other functions and purposes?
It is important. Everything is important if we see the opportunity to go deep into that situation. As I said, I'm a Swami. I have nothing in my name in the world. And I sleep on a straw mat on a floor. And I'm happy. And I get to, my happiness is in helping other people. And that's my wealth. My wealth is in whatever I can do to serve others. And whatever little wisdom God has given me to inspire others. So in my situation, that's my wealth. If a person has money and a person is using that money in the service of their family, physically, emotionally, spiritually, and helping to uplift society as well, then that money is sacred. It's divine. Money itself, according to the Indian tradition, is Lakshmi. Lakshmi is the goddess of fortune, the goddess of compassion, the goddess of love. That's Lakshmi or Radha. And when we see that this is what our money is, this is what our wealth is, this is what our intelligence is, this is what our skills are, they're all blessings of Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. And let me use it in harmony with that principle. We're not the possessors. We are the caretakers. To own something, no one can take it away from you. But at the time of death or before, everything's taken away from us. So really, we don't own anything. We are caretakers. The Gita explains, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam Sarvalokamaheshwaram, which means the peace formula of the Gita is to understand everything belongs to God. I'm the caretaker. To be an instrument of God's grace with whatever I have. And then the more money we have, if we have this character, the more we could do wonderful things for ourselves, for our family, and for the world. Yes? But God doesn't see how much. God sees the intent. There are people who just have meager incomes, and they're helping with God's work. There are people with bigger incomes, like your family, feeding 50,000 children a day, doing tremendous things for our hospital, and doing so many other educational programs, cultural programs to uplift people's consciousness. Swati Pirumal, whatever she does, it's with such art and culture and feeling and spirituality, and it's always to uplift people. She wrote, I don't know if you saw that beautiful book that was just published about her year in her position as, what is it, the Chamber of Commerce? What is it called? Associated Chamber. Anyway, she wanted to use the great wisdom and experience she had from that to elevate people's consciousness, to make people better human beings, to whatever comes is a beautiful opportunity. So yes, you know, there are people who want to help others. If millions can help more people, and billions could help more people, and trillions can make more people, then enthusiastic to do. But the consciousness that comes from a spiritual foundation is whatever is given is the property of the divine, and I'm the caretaker. That's not meant to be arrogant or greedy about it, but meant to work very dynamically and intelligently so that I could utilize it as an instrument of the divine. And there's no greater satisfaction to the heart than feeling oneself an instrument of the divine. And that's a universal spiritual principle. So wealth is beautiful like that. But at the same time, if we don't have much wealth, it's also beautiful like that. Whatever we have or don't have, if we have the right character, the right consciousness, and that spirit of servitude and compassion, it's beautiful. Does that answer your question? And you're asking it, but your family is very much the personification of that very principle. And I'm I was deeply honored and grateful to know the Piramal family. I may be a Swami and all that stuff, but I learned so much about what spiritual life is from people like this. And it's an exchange, it's a sharing. We're all trying to work together for that higher aspiration. Please, it has been such an honor and a deep joy to be with all of you. And what can I say? I'm just overwhelmed. Thank you very, very much for coming to visit us and for allowing us to serve you in this small way. And we'd love for you to come up and visit our temple. And then I think there's dinner here. And if there's anything we can do for you, please allow us to do. Thank you very, very much.
You can leave your shoes here, and everyone generally goes barefoot into the temple.